I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're going to spend a good part of the program today talking about the president's State of the Union address last night and reactions to it. In a few minutes, we'll have a newsmaker interview with one of the president's senior advisors, Valerie Jarrett. She joins us to talk about not only what the president said, but how he can actually move forward on many of these proposals. But first, we want to turn to two members of Congress who were in attendance last night. Congressman Michael Grimm is a Republican. He represents New York's 13th District. That includes parts of Staten Island and Brooklyn. Also with us, Congresswoman Loretta Sanchez. She is a Democrat who represents parts of Orange County and California's 47th District. They sat together at the State of the Union address last night, and they are seated together once again in the studios on Capitol Hill. Welcome to you both. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
First, can I just ask, how did it happen that the two of you decided to sit together? I know this is something that started last year in the wake of that awful shooting of Arizona Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords, where a number of members of different political parties decided to sit together as a kind of a show of a gesture of national unity. And so how is it decided that the two of you would sit together?
He asked me.
There you go. Absolutely.
I'm tempted to ask who saw who first, but
He asked me out on a date. I said, "Okay, let's sit over there at the
malt
State
shop.
Of the Union."
Are you friends? Do you have a friendship?
Yes,
are you on the same committee together?
Of course.
No, we are friends, and it's, you know, I think that we're probably on opposite ends of the spectrum on many different issues.
Not always.
But it is proof that she can find some common ground. And regardless, even if we have different views on certain things, we can still be civil and still have a conversation like adults and try to work things through.
I told him yesterday, he's my Ricky to my Lucy.
Okay. Well, let's talk about whether there's any common ground on what the president talked about last night. The bulk of his address was focused on the economy, and as he defined it, economic inequality. He said the defining issue of our time is keeping alive the promise that hard work will lead to a better life. Let's play a short clip for those who may not have heard it. Here it is.
No challenge is more urgent. No debate is more important. We can either settle for a country where a shrinking number of people do really well, while a growing number of Americans barely get by. Or we can restore an economy where everyone gets a fair shot and everyone does their fair share and everyone plays by the same set of rules.
I think it's only fair to give the loyal opposition the first crack at this one. So, Congressman Grimm, as a member of the loyal opposition, do you agree?
Well, I agree with the fundamental principle that we should all have equal opportunity. For me, that's what the United States stands for. That's what the American dream is. That's what my parents gave me, an opportunity. But I think the president takes it a step further and tries to guarantee outcomes. I also think that he uses a big government approach to bring forth all opportunity, and that just doesn't work. You know, the success of the United States has been that we're a capitalist society. We have a free market, and everyone should have access and an opportunity, but we certainly shouldn't be in any way guaranteeing outcomes from the federal government.
Congresswoman Sanchez, Mr. Grimm says that the president is actually trying to guarantee outcomes, and other members of his party have called this, you know, quote unquote, class warfare. What do you say?
I think that President Obama did great last night. I think anytime you can start a speech with, "We got Osama bin Laden, I got the troops out of Iraq, and GM is selling cars all over the world," I think from the very get-go, he told people, "We're working on this, it's getting there, and we're going to have jobs." And with respect to the outcomes, I mean, you have only to look at General Motors to understand it's not a free market. We, the Congress, put money towards that, and they're coming back. They're making more cars. They're selling more cars, better cars, and they're the number one automaker in the world today. And that was because we strategically decided it was worth having manufacturing and good jobs attached to that here in the United States. I think he did a great job.
Do you think he made an effective enough case for the role of government in the economy, even if you don't agree with Congressman Grimm that he's actually trying to guarantee outcomes? Do you think he made an effective enough case?
Absolutely. Again, we turn to the GM situation, and you understand that people are getting jobs. We're selling cars. We're the number one car automaker now across the world. And in a very strategic way, we put some outlay, some monies on the table, and we are paid back with interest, and we have jobs in manufacturing. And that's what we need to look at. We need to look and say, how do we bring back manufacturing to the United States? And it wasn't just the fact that we put the money in. It's the fact that GM retooled, rethought, and made better cars that Americans actually want.
We're talking about the President's State of the Union address last night. It was delivered last night. We're talking with two lawmakers, Congresswoman Loretta Sanchez, she's a Democrat from California, and Michael Grimm is a Republican who represents a district in New York. Let me just play another clip from the President last night. Talking about, he obviously, as is customary in the State of the Union address, or at least has become customary, he had a lot of legislative proposals. But he also addressed the fact that this is an election year and addressing the question that many people would have about whether it's actually realistic to propose these kinds of things in an election year where there's already a very sharp partisan divide. Here it is.
Now, I recognize that people watching tonight have differing views about taxes and debt, energy and health care. But no matter what party they belong to, I bet most Americans are thinking the same thing right about now. Nothing will get done in Washington this year, or next year, or maybe even the year after that, because Washington is broken. Can you blame them for feeling a little cynical?
Congressman Sanchez, couldn't you argue that the president's being a little cynical by introducing these measures, given that this Congress, which is your house, is controlled by the Republicans, has been very skeptical, particularly about his economic initiatives? Couldn't you argue that he's being cynical, too?
You know, politics goes on all the time, especially in the House of Representatives. I mean, we run every 2 years, if you think about it. So we play, in particular in the House, we play with politics in and around elections looming all the time around the corner from us. If I would decide not to introduce legislation simply because there were political fears or the fear that the Republicans wouldn't accept or that I couldn't find the votes, then I'd probably never introduce legislation. But the fact of the matter is, we introduce legislation because we believe in it, because we believe we can go around, because we want to work hard, we want to find those votes. And so if the president wants to propose something and he can get enough votes on it, then he should be doing it. He shouldn't just say it's a political year, so I'm not going to do it, or the Republicans control the House and I'm not going to do it. And all you have to do is go back and look at history, and you can see proposals that came from presidents when the House was held by the opposite party and they became law.
Mr. Grimm, did you hear anything in the president's speech last night that you can agree on or support?
Well, I mean, obviously, there's a lot of common ground. The question is whether I believe the president is sincere and genuine with wanting to work with us across the aisle. For example, taxes. Everyone knows that the tax system is broken and we need to work on that. So there's common ground that, you know, I've been beating the drum on for an entire year. I know a lot of my Republican colleagues have, but he really hasn't met us at the table. You know, again, I think it comes back to, yes, it was a very rhetorical speech. He's a great orator, but, you know, he ended with you have to have each other's backs. And he used a military analogy of, you know, going up those stairs. And having been in harm's way for 16 years, I was in combat with the Marine Corps and I was a special agent of the FBI. I've put my life in others' arms and vice versa. You know, just recently when they wanted to extend the payroll tax, the president himself, I was there, said it would be inexcusable not to extend it for a year. I really believe the president. And we said, here's an opportunity to find common ground and show the people before the year is over that we can work together. And then he did a complete reversal and I feel pulled the rug out from under myself and my Republican colleagues. And we ended up with the 2-month deal and Republicans looking terrible like we wanted to raise taxes, which is absurd. So, you know, after something like that happens, no, I don't trust that the president has my back. I don't believe that he wants to work with me. I think that he wants to run against a broken Congress, which is why he mentioned it, because he can't run on his failed record or his failed policy.
We just heard from Congressman Michael Grimm. He is a Republican who represents New York's 13th district. Congresswoman Loretta Sanchez is a Democrat. She represents California's 47th district. They sat together at last night's State of the Union address, and they were both kind enough to join us together from the studios on Capitol Hill. We want to turn now to White House Senior Advisor Valerie Jarrett, and she is with us from the White House. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Good morning, Michelle.
We've been talking about the main focus of the president's speech, which is the economy. I just want to play another short clip from the address for people who did not have a chance to hear it. Here it is.
The state of our union is getting stronger. And we've come too far to turn back now. As long as I'm president, I will work with anyone in this chamber to build on this momentum. But I intend to fight obstruction with action, and I will oppose any effort to return to the very same policies that brought on this economic crisis in the first place.
There are two things in that sentence that we want to talk about. So let's start with the first thing, the substance of it. The unemployment rate is now 8.5%. That's a little better than when we spoke last September, but it's almost double where the country was 5 years ago. Can the president really make the case that things are getting better?
Oh, absolutely, Michelle. And he began last night by highlighting that in the last 6 months of the prior administration, we lost 4 million jobs. In the first 6 months of the Obama administration, before any of his policies could take hold, we lost another 4 million jobs. Now, over the last 22 months, we've had private sector job growth each and every month. We've created 3.2 million jobs. So we're clearly on the right path. But as you pointed out, the unemployment rate is still far too high, and we have a long way to go. But we are certainly moving in the right direction.
We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we will have more with White House Senior Advisor Valerie Jarrett. We're talking about the president's State of the Union address. Please stay with us. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, NPR senior business editor Marilyn G. Wax will be with us once again. She'll be fact-checking the economic portions of the president's speech. But we have more now with White House senior advisor Valerie Jarrett. She's one of the president's closest advisors. She's a key member of the team. She was with the president at the State of the Union address last night, and she's with us from the White House. The president also said that he will fight obstruction with action to get his plans for the economic recovery through, or another plans that he feels are essential to help the country. You know, a lot of Republicans are saying that this really wasn't a State of the Union address last night. This is really the opening campaign speech. To the degree to which the president does continue to make unilateral moves, say use his recess appointment power and things like that, do you have a concern that that will just further inflame feelings on Capitol Hill, that it will make it even harder to get things done legislatively, even where there are opportunities to work together in a bipartisan fashion?
Well, you have to look at the stakes, Michelle. The stakes are very high. You mentioned recess appointments. A couple of weeks ago, the president appointed Rich Cordray to head the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Why did he do that? He did that because under the Dodd-Frank legislation, an integral part of that legislation was to make sure that for the first time, we have one agency whose sole responsibility it is to look out for the consumer. Well, the Republicans in Congress oppose having that entity. They didn't want to have a consumer watchdog. And that's why they opposed Rich Cordray. Not that they had any concern with him. In fact, Rich enjoyed bipartisan support among his colleagues when he used to be the Attorney General of Ohio. And so this wasn't an issue of their being a concern about Rich. It was their objecting to the principle that we have this policy in place. And what the president said is, look, consumers all around this country have suffered as a result of not having rules of the road. We need a person who's going to be looking out for the consumer. The other component for why this was so important to appoint Riches is that a part of the provisions of the law didn't go into effect until you had a director of the agency. So they were unable to regulate, for example, payday lenders. They were unable to regulate mortgage brokers. Some of the bad actors who had such a terrible impact on the consumer throughout this economy. And so I think the short answer to your question is the president's focus is not on politics. His focus is on what is important for the American people. The election is months away, but we can't afford to wait until then to look out for the people who have been so disadvantaged by all of the bad acts that took place a few years ago that led to this economic crisis.
The president also again introduced the idea, as he has before, of the need, as he sees it, to raise taxes on the richest Americans. He raised again the question of the fairness of the tax rate for someone like Warren Buffett being lower than for Warren Buffett's secretary, who actually happened to be in attendance last night, or not happened to be, who was in attendance last night.
You invited her, yes.
So how do you respond, though, to the Republican argument that this plays into the narrative that Democrats are more interested in raising taxes than cutting spending?
Well, the president was very clear last night. I think he's absolutely committed to reducing our deficit. And I think the point he made last night is, look, we only have so many pots to look to. And if we want to bring down the deficit, we have to restructure our tax system. We also have to restructure it because we have to make it more fair. And so if we really want to, for example, encourage manufacturing to come back to the United States, well, that money has to come from somewhere. And the president made the point, Michelle, that, look, we celebrate success. That's what America's all about. Entrepreneurs who can start a business in their basement and have it grow into a global company. That's exactly what we want. But that entrepreneur didn't do it alone. They hired a workforce that was trained by our public schools. They use our roads, our bridges, our railways, our internet, all which was created by government. And government is there to do what the private sector can't do. Many of our advances in science and technology were seeded through government. And that's his point, is if we really want to be a world leader, the world leader that we are, if we want to maintain our competitive advantage, we have got to figure out how we can bring down the deficit yet invest in business. And so if you think about all the different pots that are available to you, isn't it only fair that those who've done so well pay a little bit more? And I think the reason why he invited Debbie to be a guest in the box is because she's really a perfect example of somebody who works really, really hard. And is it fair that she pays a higher tax rate than her boss, Warren Buffett? Warren Buffett doesn't think so.
I'm speaking with Valerie Jarrett, senior advisor to President Obama. And of course, we're talking about last night's State of the Union address. You know, another area where the president laid out a clear philosophical difference with the Republicans in Congress and also many leading Republicans around the country was around energy policy. And of course, this has been, you know, very hotly debated issue. The president decided not to go forward with a pipeline, you know, from Canada. Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels, who delivered the Republican response to the president's address last night, talked about this. I just want to play a short clip of what he said. Here it is.
Extremism that stifles the development of homegrown energy or cancels a perfectly safe pipeline that would employ tens of thousands or jacks up consumer utility bills for no improvement in either human health or world temperature is a pro-poverty policy.
Clearly, the argument is forming that the president is not taking advantage of opportunities for economic growth like this pipeline, and it makes the argument that creating jobs as a number one priority rings hollow to people like Mitch Daniels. How do you respond to that?
Well, let's talk about the pipeline. The fact of the matter is when we were negotiating the extension of the payroll tax, the Republicans put the pipeline on the table. And they tried to force the president to make a decision under a timeline that at the time the Secretary of State said very clearly that they had not completed their environmental review. And Secretary Clinton said before the payroll tax extension was passed, do not give us a deadline because we will not be able to meet that deadline. And if you do, then we're going to have to turn it down. So they had, the Republicans had all the warning in advance that if they set this arbitrary deadline, we'd have to turn it down, as opposed to just letting it go through the normal process and perhaps approving it, perhaps configuring the route. I mean, there were a whole range of possibilities, but they precluded any of that by insisting on this drop-dead deadline. And I guess the question is, what did the pipeline have to do with extending the payroll tax in the first place? And the other point the president made last night about continuing to extend the payroll tax, which is so important for 160 million Americans who depend on this, $40 a paycheck is a big deal. I was sitting next to a woman last night who had written in about what she would do with her $40, and she explained to me how important that is to her just to get by. And so why would we burden that piece of legislation with other pieces of legislation that aren't germane?
And finally, Valerie Jarrett, obviously there are many, many things we could talk about. We haven't at all even talked about the foreign policy, and I regret that. But before we let you go, I wanted to talk about another proposal that the president has announced last night that he said would allow homeowners to save around $3,000 a year by refinancing their mortgages. The reason I'm bringing that up is, once again, the criticism from the left is it makes a good press release, but the policy really isn't there. The money's not going to be there. Members of Congress aren't going to support this, so that's really for show. And it also replays into a Republican narrative that the president's already had 3 years to put his ideas into practice. It hasn't turned the economy around, so this is why it's time to give somebody else a chance.
Well, it's time to go back to the practices that got us into this mess to begin with. I mean, what the Republicans have been saying is, let's get rid of the rules of the road. You know, let's not hold banks accountable. And what the president is saying is, look, the housing crisis, not only has it hurt so many individual families, that is having a devastating impact on our economy and a devastating impact on the families involved. So let's forge together and figure out a solution. And so there are two different perspectives. Do you want to get rid of the rules of the road? Do you want to let everybody just do whatever they want to do? Or do you want to really look out for the consumer, look out for the American people, and figure out ways to create and foster an environment where companies want to double down on America? We had a meeting here at the White House a few weeks ago where the president invited companies from around the country who had outsourced jobs outside of the United States and then made the decision to bring those jobs back. Well, we need to be encouraging that. We need to be investing in manufacturing and small businesses. We need to be creating a workforce where Americans can compete in a global marketplace because they have the necessary skills. And we need fairness, and we need a sustainable, strong economy that's durable for the future. That's the president's vision. That's what he outlined last night. In the days and weeks ahead, you will see considerable more detail than he could possibly contain in one speech and flesh out all of the different policy programs that he announced last night, and look forward to engaging with the Republicans, because the American people, Michelle, they expect the elected officials who represent them to take action. And the president's strong message last night is he's going to take action. He's willing to work with anyone in the chamber. He's also going to do everything within his power and in the executive branch to move our country forward.
Valerie Jarrett is senior advisor to President Obama, and she was kind enough to join us from the White House. Valerie Jarrett, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Michelle. Have a great day.
The economy was such a focus of the president's speech last night that we thought it was appropriate to check in with NPR senior business editor Marilyn Geewax. Marilyn, thanks for coming in once again.
Hi.
Now, you just heard from senior White House advisor Valerie Jarrett. And the president said that, quote, the state of the union is getting stronger. But I think you heard Ms. Jarrett say that a lot more is yet to do. So where are we really?
Well, the state of the economy at this moment is actually pretty good, at least compared with where we've been. Now, I know if you're unemployed, it doesn't feel that way at all. But if you look at what happened in December, for example, 200,000 jobs were created. Last August, people were talking about the possibility of a double dip recession. They thought the economy was actually contracting. But now we're getting the data that shows in the fourth quarter, in the towards the end of the year, actually it was probably pretty good, better than 3%. So if you're looking at the economy at this very moment, corporations have a lot of cash on hand. That means they can add to hiring. We've got the unemployment rate is down from about 10% at the worst to 8.5%. Those are good things. And they say when you're an incumbent, the trend is your friend. So you want to not look at so much where have we been, but where are we headed. And if you look ahead, the economy seems to be on a fairly good path. But and that's a very big but, there are some really major uncertainties out there that could change that trajectory by November.
Well, let's talk about that. What are those things? What are the things that maybe just give me three things that economists are particularly
always,
worried about?
lots of things to worry about, but the big three right now, there are three foreign factors that are really weighing on economists' mind if they're going to break bad for us. Number one is the European debt crisis. That's a serious problem. Hasn't been solved, and it could get much, much worse, destabilizing financial markets around the world. Number two, oil prices. You know, people really relate to gasoline prices. It matters a lot to consumers, and understandably, that if gasoline is rising, that's a real problem for you. So it's also a problem if you're running for re-election. But we have a lot of tension in the Middle East. Iran is a situation that it could go bad at any moment. So that's a real threat. And then number three, China has been looking like it might be heading towards a recession. That would be bad for us. And then, well, there's a big, giant fourth factor, and that is a domestic problem and what's going to happen with Congress.
Well, I was going to ask, though, because the things that you enumerated, I mean, from the standpoint of being incumbents, I mean, both, you know, members of Congress and the president, there are obviously everybody in the House of Representatives, as Loretta Sanchez pointed out, are all running, and, of course, a significant mm-hmm. Third of the Senate. So they're all on the ballot. And none of those things that you talked about really have anything to do with anything they can control. Yeah. What about the things that they can control? I know that you went to a briefing of some key members of Congress. Was there any sense that they found any common ground with the president, or are there areas that they think they can work together?
Yes, this morning, National Journal and The Atlantic put on this program where some key members of Congress were invited to talk about what they see happening this year. And that's this fear that economists have that nothing will get done this year, that there will be this really serious gridlock that could trigger problems with the economy. And from what I heard this morning, there's good reason for those fears. For example, Congressman Paul Ryan, he's the head of the House Budget Committee, talked about his perception of President Obama's leadership and would he get anything done. And he literally said about President Obama, quote, he has shown nothing but demagoguery, end quote, on the issue of things like entitlement reform, Social Security.
And
he said that he could not work with this president, that all serious economic advances on issues like Social Security and Medicare would have to await a new president.
So does that reflect the feeling of the entire House leadership? I mean, he's the chair of the Budget Committee, which is certainly a key and influential role.
Well, that's what
but
he seems to be.
Does that reflect the perspective of the leadership?
I would say that there seemed to be a feeling there. There was also Senator Barrasso, a Republican from Wyoming. He was talking about some of the smaller issues. Ryan was talking about this really big stuff, Social Security reform. But Barrasso was talking about the payroll tax holiday that we're going to have in January and February. The president wants to extend that for the full year. But Republicans have attached to that and the issue of this pipeline, an oil pipeline called the Keystone Pipeline.
That Valerie Jarrett was just talking about a minute ago, saying that the two have nothing to do with each other, so why are they related?
Well, Republicans feel that this is the payroll tax holiday. It has to do with helping the economy. They feel the pipeline has to do with helping the economy, and they want those issues linked. The president has made it very clear he does not want those linked. So listening to those kinds of comments, you do have a feeling that a real problem for the economy this year may be that effectively it's a dead year in terms of getting anything accomplished in Congress, and that could be problematic.
So, Marilyn G. Wex, before we let you go, the next big political event in the presidential race is the Republican primary in Florida on January 31st. And it's really hard to talk about Florida without talking about the housing crisis. And as we mentioned earlier, the president made a proposal to allow homeowners to refinance that he said would save, you know, significant dollars. I just wanted to – we don't know a lot about the plan to this point, but how significant an issue is housing as in the consciousness of the American people, as part of the economic recovery?
This is really a huge issue all over the country, certainly, but Florida has really been ground zero for this housing problem. The states that have been pummeled, Nevada, Arizona, California, Florida, they continue to really struggle with this problem. And as a result, their unemployment rate is higher. As I said, in the United States, unemployment is about 8.5%. In Florida, it's closer to 10%. In some places, in like in the Tampa area, it's above 10%. And if you talk to anybody down in Florida, they all say it's tied to housing. Until you really get at that problem of these foreclosures and the underwater factor, about 44% of the people in Florida who own a home, their house is worth less than they owe.
44%.
That's a lot.
That's a lot.
So that weighs on voters' minds, and that's a swing state. It's going to be an issue in this election.
Marilyn Giewentz is NPR senior business editor. She was nice enough to join us once again in our Washington, D.C. studios. Marilyn, thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Coming up, the ladies head into the beauty shop to give their take on the president's State of the Union address. Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels wasn't the only response. The Tea Party chose former GOP presidential candidate Herman Cain to weigh in.
We the people are coming. That's the Tea Party message to Washington, the president, and his administration. We the people are coming.
Politics and more in the beauty shop. That's coming up on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now it's time to head into the beauty shop. That's where we get a fresh cut on some of the week's news. The ladies are going to weigh in on the president's State of the Union address and reaction from Capitol Hill and the Tea Party. We'll also talk about a comprehensive new survey about how Black women see themselves and their place in society. This is the first time this has been done in years, if at all. Very interesting findings. And some sad news about the latest Hollywood breakup. Say It Ain't So, Seal and Heidi Klum. With us to talk about these stories are Viviana Hurtado, blogger-in-chief of the website The Wise Latina Club. Shelby Blakely is the journalist coordinator for the Tea Party Patriots. She's been with us before to tell us about doings in the Tea Party. Her group is a grassroots organization which supports local Tea Party groups. Danielle Belton is back with us. She's author of the blog The Black Snob. She's also a contributor to Essence Magazine. And Krissa Thompson is a national staff writer at The Washington Post. She was one of the writers on that series on Black women. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Oh, Thanks for having us, Michelle.
So we spent a good part of the program today talking about the State of the Union address and kind of reactions to it. We heard from a newsmaker interview, Valerie Jarrett, key advisor to the president. We heard members of Congress from both sides of the aisle. So, of course, we heard Marilyn's take. But now I want to make you part of my Tell Me More focus group, if that's okay, and get your thoughts about the State of the Union and the responses to it. One person we hadn't heard from yet to this point is the former Republican presidential candidate Herman Cain, who was asked to speak on behalf of the Tea Party. Remember, Michelle Bachmann, Minnesota Congresswoman, gave the response last year. Here's just a short clip of Herman Cain, if you didn't hear it, because it came in kind of late. Here it is.
With all due respect, Mr. President, some of us are not stupid. The State of the Union is not good. We want common sense solutions. That's how we do it outside of Washington. And we happen to believe that we need more common sense solutions inside of Washington.
So, Shelby, I'm going to go to you first because you're a member of the Tea Party Patriots. Did Herman Cain, did he hit it out of the park for you? Did he convey your concerns?
Well, there were a lot of similarities between his message and the sentiments we're receiving from the Tea Party, but Herman Cain is not a spokesman for the Tea Party, and neither is Michelle Bachmann. Every year, it seems you've got somebody claiming to speak for the Tea Party, when in reality, you cannot speak for who you do not speak to, and it's not really a concerted effort. Sometimes you feel like it's being hijacked for some odd reason.
Would you have liked it better if there had been no response from somebody claiming to speak for the Tea Party? You think that would have been better?
I think it would have been better if a Tea Party response would have come from someone who works within the Tea Party. Jenny Beth Martin is co-founder of Tea Party Patriots, Mark Meckler, myself, local coordinators, state coordinators from across the country. There are literally millions of people in the Tea Party, and I would rather have someone answer who has been putting in the hard work of political activism as opposed to someone who just finished running for president.
Okay. Just to clarify, Tea Party Express invited Herman Cain. And so for what that's worth. But Shelby, thanks for that. Viviana, what about you? What of all the speeches that you heard last night, what was the thing that stood out for you?
I think it's interesting that there were a lot of Republican responses. We know that the official response was given by Mitch Daniel, a governor of Indiana, and the response in Spanish was given by Kiko Canseco, Texas representative. And what they had in common was really hitting the president hard on his record on unemployment, as well as out-of-control spending and the whole notion that Washington is broken. Interestingly, though, the president hit on those same themes. And so the question really is, going forward, whose side is the American people going to take? And what's interesting is, even though for a third year polling, President Obama has low approval ratings at about 44.5%, here's another number that's really interesting to look at. ABC News has people who surveyed approval of Congress at 13% and congressional Republicans at 21%. And so we're in an election year. We saw that this State of the Union is President Obama making that first pitch effort, and he's out in battleground states the next 3 days to sell it. The question is, will the American people going to buy it? And they are going to buy a vision. Is it going to be his?
Danielle, what about you? What do you think?
Well, I feel like it's such a huge contrast. I mean, you have President Obama, who's, you know, who's very positive, very patriotic, you know, even talking about the military successes, kind of State of the Union. And you've got the Republican responses, which have all been hyping pretty much on the negative, on how bad things are and how bad the economy is. And so it's such an interesting contrast, considering that people want things to get better. They want to hear solutions how to get things better. But the only person who actually believes the government can actually do something about making things better is the president. The Republicans are all pretty much running on a platform that government can't fix things. All our salvation is in capitalism in the free market.
You know what was funny, though? I don't know if any of you saw the interview with that Brian Williams of NBC News did with Mitt Romney last night, the sort of kind of leader of the field of the Republican presidential candidates. And he said that Obama stole his ideas. So which is it? I mean, which is it?
Well, I mean, if he stole his ideas next week, he won't like those ideas then, because that's pretty much been the pattern when Obama co-opts a former Republican idea. All of a sudden, they don't own it anymore.
Well, Chris, I'm not going to ask you to weigh in and give an opinion on this, because I know you're a field reporter. And if you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're having our visit to the beauty shop, where we get a fresh cut on issues in the news. And we're joined by Danielle Belton of the Black Snob blog. That's who was speaking just now. Viviana Hurtado of the WiseLatinaClub.com. Shelby Blakely of the Tea Party Patriots. And now we're going to hear from Krissa Thompson, because you worked on this very interesting series done in conjunction between the Washington Post and the Kaiser Family Foundation. They conducted this extensive nationwide survey of Black women's views. Krissa, I can't remember a comprehensive project like this. Can you?
No. And we...
What motivated it?
We, 6 years ago, we did a similar project on Black men. It was called Being a Black Man. And that really bubbled up in the newsroom. There were men who remembered a decade prior. We'd had the Million Men March, and, you know, President Obama at that time, he was in the Senate, and, you know, folks were talking about him as a potential presidential candidate. And so the idea of really taking a look at where Black men were in America, and a similar a feeling has come up about Black women. We have books looking at the image of Black women in society. Conversations have organically been taking place, and it just felt like the right time.
To add some rigor to that conversation. Mm-hmm. Some of the findings, I don't know what struck you. I'll just read some of them for folks who haven't had a chance to check out the series yet. 40% of the Black women surveyed say getting married is very important, but that compares with 55% of white women. This finding was among those, a number that showed some real differences in the outlook and experiences of Black women, according to the poll. Here's some others. More than a fifth of Black women say that being wealthy is very important, compared with 1 in 20 white women. And 67% of Black women describe themselves as having high self-esteem, compared with 43% of white women. But also, a significant number of Black women say that they experience a lot of stress and have trouble paying their bills, even though they feel really positive overall about their lives. So, Krissa, I'm interested in what stood out for you as a person who looked at all of this.
There was one figure that really struck me, and it was we asked a question, how important is being very successful in your career? And for Black women overall, I think something like 68% said that being successful in their careers were very important. And then when you looked at Black women under the age of 35, 98% said it was very important. And that contrasted with white women, who we also oversampled. And it was something like 15 percentage points less important. So when you think about that figure and sort of what that means, I really wanted to probe what our ideas of success are today.
Mm. Danielle, what did you think? That's your crowd.
Well, it really fell in the line what I already kind of believe and think, and conversations that I've had with my peers, where I feel like Black women are reacting to a reality, an economic reality that we've always dealt with. You know, my grandmothers on both sides had to work. My great grandmothers had to work. And so the message my mom and me and my sisters got was, you cannot depend on a man to take care of you. Even if you get a husband, there's a good chance that he might be unemployed. He might not be able to get a high wage earning job. You need to be just as educated. You need to succeed in order to take care of yourself and any potential children you might have. And a lot of Black women, regardless of their educational background, have gotten that same message. Therefore, you see that overemphasis on their careers as opposed to whether or not they'll get married.
Do you see it as overemphasis?
Well, I don't think it's, I think it's a good emphasis. I mean, to be honest, I mean, I think it's a good thing for women to take stock of themselves and to value themselves and to find self-worth in their careers and their communities.
Yeah, Shelby, how does that strike you? I'm interested in your take on it.
Well, I have to agree with both Danielle and Viviana that Black women are reacting to a reality. And the Black community for quite a few decades now has had to deal with large amounts of poverty. And that's just a natural reaction to it. Right now in this country, one out of every seven people are on food stamps. And that's a reality that everyone has to adjust to and accommodate for. So I think it's a very good thing that they are paying attention to their surroundings and understanding that no one is coming to save them. And that they are taking charge and taking action, I think it's a great thing.
But doesn't it kind of defy the stereotypes, though, that people are sitting around waiting for somebody to save them?
Well, when it comes to the sheer number of people in this country that are dependent on the federal government, that get a check from the federal government, it's absolutely staggering.
But most of those people aren't black, though, right? I mean,
there's a higher percentage of Black people who are. To receive some sort of entitlement check, but the reality isn't different. If you are receiving a check from the government, you are most likely
to be older.
Around the poverty level.
No, well, I mean, I think the largest entitlement programs, as we know, are geared toward the elderly. So I think that that's a fact. And it is also true, just to clarify this for people who don't know, the largest percentage of people who receive food stamps in this country overwhelmingly are white. In fact, African Americans are far less likely to receive food stamps than other groups, even though there's a larger percentage of Black people who are poor. So I just think it's important to clarify those. Viviana, you haven't weighed on this. That was Krissa Thompson, who was talking earlier, who worked on this series. Viviana, your thoughts about this?
I thought it was interesting. Krissa's article wrote that for a lot of young Black women, they were looking at the trails that people like Michelle Obama, Oprah Winfrey blazed, and that that was giving them inspiration to really reach for the stars. And I thought it was interesting that Michelle Obama, to Gail King on CBS, spoke about the weight of this stereotype, this label of being an angry Black woman. And so it's interesting to see that even though there's incredible advances, there still is a lot of, I guess, molds that Black women and all women of color are still breaking. And I just wanted to say as well that I'm looking forward to a similar study in the Latino community, because Latina women as well are weighed down by a lot of cultural low expectations as well as low societal expectations. And so I don't see a lot of the women in the media besides hot tamales or maids. And, of course, we know that there are a real multiplicity of Latino women, particularly the U.S. born. They're becoming more educated. They're more career focused. They're leading their families and their household incomes.
And we are certainly heard from one of those people this morning, Loretta Sanchez, member of Congress, who is nobody's. She might be hot, but she's nobody's tamale, right? So, anyway, you know, the survey did talk a lot about love and marriage, too, which is interesting. But, you know, this, and the celebrity kind of relationship news, there's the news that supermodel Heidi Klum and singer Seal are breaking up after, what, 7 or 8 years of marriage. And, you know, this is one of those things that is just a bummer. I'm sorry. It's just a bummer. Just because you don't see, you know, they, unlike some people, don't seem to be playing their relationship out in the media, except that, you know, they do a lot of red carpets, as you might imagine, since she is in fashion. And then you hear that Aretha Franklin has called off her engagement. So I don't know, Danielle, what is that? Does that bum you out to hear this, or you just
it reminds me that no matter your economic status or your celebrity status, you still have to deal with people one-on-one like everyone else does. So you still fall in love. You still deal with all the negatives and the positives that come with that love. And so just because looking on the outside, this couple is wonderful, beautiful, and looks gorgeous and perfect, they still probably had all the same problems we all have with our partners, and it just became overwhelming for them.
Oh, you just have too much common sense. I'm sorry. I just don't remember that. Shelby, what about you? Were you clutching your pearls when you heard this news?
Well, honestly, it's happening more and more, and it's happening so often that marriage now is defined as, will you be my soulmate for the next 5 to 10 years? Mm-hmm. And after that, all bets are off. But, I mean, there's 4 kids involved in this mess, and they're going to have to figure out how to, you know, split households and share time between parents. And I think the kids really get forgotten and lost in this idea that we've grown apart or we've fallen out of love. I mean, these are real people, and there's going to be real injury no matter how amicable a split up is.
I hear you. Do you think it is worth mentioning those children are very young? In fact, the youngest is only two. Shelby, do you think, and Vivian, you might want to weigh in this as well, do you think that the celebrities are leading or following on this?
I think they're leading because they do have more lavish lifestyles. They do have more luxurious lifestyles. I mean, we hear reports in Europe and even in this country where people are getting divorced, but they're still living in the same house because they can't afford to split up households. But that's not normally true in the celebrity realm. And so I think because their lives are more luxurious and they don't have to deal with things like going to the grocery store or paying a light bill, that they tend to indulge their desires a little bit more. And one of those desires might just be a hotter looking lady that hasn't had as many kids.
Well, ow. I'm sorry. I don't think it gets much hotter than Heidi. Sorry. I don't know.
I was thinking.
Chrissy, you know, in a survey, though, did the women you talked to talk a lot about their desires for a partnership, some sort of a committed partnership?
In follow-up interviews, they did. And the emphasis on career versus marriage, which we did see some dichotomy with, has to do with what you feel like you can control. And Black women in the survey felt like, you know what, I can't do anything about finding a mate, so I'm going to pour my energy and resources where I can.
And did they feel okay with that, or were they sad about it?
In a yes or no survey, you can't get at that. In follow-up interviews, there did seem to be some sense of loss, but also they're very satisfied with their lives.
And Vivian, a final thought from you about this. You know, I'm also kind of sad about Aretha, but I'm still hoping that things will work out for her in the end, for no other reason than I know she'll have a fabulous hat.
Indeed. I just wanted to say that there is no bigger proponent of marriage than me. My parents celebrated their 49th wedding anniversary January 2nd. My brother's been married for 12 years. My sister's been married for 6 years. I am the exception to the rule only because I haven't found Mr. Right. And why does this matter, what I'm saying? Because when Aretha decided that she was just going to cool things off right now, I couldn't help but think she was just saying, hold on a second. And what I really realized was how uncomfortable it made the rest of us, society. Maybe we want a really big wedding, but maybe the real R-E-S-P-E-C-T for women is to allow them the option.
Hold on. Okay. We all have just too much common sense. Well, we have to go out on a little Aretha. Here's her song, Since You've Been Gone. Although R-E-S-P-C-T is always a good one. Joining us, that's right, Fabiana Hurtado is blogger-in-chief of the website The Wise Latina Club. Krista Thompson is a national staff writer for The Washington Post. Danielle Belton is behind the pop culture and politics blog The Black Snob. They were all here in Washington, D.C. Shelby Blakely is the journalist coordinator for the Tea Party Patriots. She joined us from NPR member station WABE in Atlanta. Ladies, thank you all.
Thank you.
Thanks,
thank
Michelle. You.